This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Mexico's Revolution Then and Now is the title of Dr. James D. Cockcroft's new book on Mexico. One review from Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz says it's a beautifully, passionately written work that clarifies, informs, and calls for action. This is the 100th anniversary of the Mexican Revolution. What lessons do we learn from it then, and what can we do with it now?
We'll hear excerpts from a reading and discussion from the talk Gaza in Crisis, Reflections on Israel's War Against the Palestinians by Ilan Pape. Ilan Pape has been called Israel's bravest, most principled, most incisive historian. Stay with us.
James D. Cockcroft's Mexico's Revolution Then and Now was written for the centennial of the Mexican Revolution of 1910, and it's a radical scholar's guide to radical Mexico. Both a scholar and a political activist, Cockcroft writes as a partisan of the oppressed and exploited and an opponent of capitalism. Inspired in large measure by the thought of Ricardo Flores Magón, Mexico's anarchist revolutionary of the beginning of the last century, Jim's book is on the one hand a breathlessly romantic account of the struggle for justice, and on the other hand, the story of the defeat of the movement, punctuated with dark passages describing the repression of the past and the difficulties facing the nation today. Dr. James D. Cockcroft is a bilingual poet and award-winning author of 48 books on Latin America, Mexico, and the United States. He serves on the International Organizing Committee of Networks in Defense of Humanity and the International Committee for the Freedom of the Cuban Five. Dr. James D. Cockcroft, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Jim, your new book, I think it's your 45th or 46th book, Mexico's Revolution Then and Now, is just a very fine book. I think every radical activist within the sound of my voice should pick it up. A monthly review published it last month. It commemorates the 100th anniversary of the Mexican Revolution, and it talks about the lessons then and now, and talks about what's going on in Mexico now. Even though country of Mexico abuts the United States, I think because of the media there and here, people really don't know what's going on there. Okay. And so what I'd like to do is ask you about your current evaluation of what's happening in Mexico, and then let's talk about the Mexican Revolution and what lessons we can learn from that. So with respect to the government of Mexico, do you regard it as legitimate? Secondly, what's its relationship between the United States and it?
Well, you should understand, Michael, that Mexico has a long history of U.S. meddling in its internal affairs. Direct military intervention, direct military conquest of half the country a century and a half ago. Torture, by the way. There's a record of U.S. sponsoring torture and training torturers in Mexico that goes all the way back to the U.S. torturers of the conquest of half of Mexico in the so-called U.S.-Mexico War of 1846-48.
Well, you could call that the first U.S. imperialist war.
You certainly could.
And I remember there was a huge anti-war movement in the United States against that. People like Abraham Lincoln were against it. Mark Twain was against it. Henry David Thoreau refused to pay taxes. They put him in prison. Right. And when Emerson came to visit him, Emerson said, "What are you doing in there?" And Thoreau made that famous remark to Emerson, "What are you doing out there?"
Exactly.
So there's been that 150-year history. Yeah.
Well, recently there was on Mexican television a video of a U.S. torturer training Mexican torturers in the police. And there are other examples I could cite ad nauseum of that part of the story. But what's really involved, obviously, is oil, water, natural resources, cheap labor power, inexpensive labor power, or the migratory flow north out of Mexico. A third of the Mexican workforce is either unemployed or working inside the United States. They've headed north, in other words.
And three-quarters of the Mexican workforce are impoverished.
Well, more than three-fourths of the entire population are impoverished. Almost half of that poverty is extreme poverty. So you have a very explosive situation in Mexico. So what does U.S. imperialism do about it? It, first of all, gets rid of the old government, the longest ruling single party in the history of humankind, the PRI, in 2000, by supporting the more conservative option to that government, the PAN, or the Party of National Action, which has governed Mexico from 2000 to the present. And that party, its first president, Fox, declared his government, and now his successor has echoed the same public proclamation, as a government by, for, and of big business.
And Fox himself was the head of
Coca-Cola.
You can't make this up, of Coca-Cola in Mexico. They proclaim themselves as the party of big business.
Exactly, and they're proud of it. The real business, however, is transnational corporations and U.S. business interests and the banks. Mexico's banking sector has been 99% privatized under neoliberalism over the last 28 years in Mexico. And the NAFTA agreement, the free trade agreement between Canada, Mexico, and the United States, resulted in the failure of almost a million small and medium businesses just in the first 10 years of the agreement, the layoff of millions of workers, and, of course, the complete destruction of the Mexican countryside. The World Bank itself and other institutions refer to it as a devastation of Mexico's countryside. Why? Because cheaper crops are imported under NAFTA than that flood the Mexican market and drive the peasantry into immiseration and poverty, and into the cities, and some of them join the migratory flow north, although the majority of the migratory flow north is from better-off people who are sinking into the lower classes because they can afford the thousands of dollars it takes to pay the coyotes to get them across the border. So it's a story that I explain in this new book as well as earlier works of mine, and I claim, and I think I document it, and summarize it to the best of my ability in this new book, Mexico's Revolution Then and Now, that U.S. imperialism has a very direct goal to annex Mexico economically, which is partially done already, and if need be, militarily occupy it if the other method it's using ultimately fails. The other method it's using now, although it is sending troops into Mexico and training all the Mexican military through the School of the Americas and other such notorious institutions that train torturers, is trying to, through the propaganda of the mass media in both countries, suggest that Mexico is a failed state and that there are these narco gangs cutting off people's heads and killing civilians and so on. Well, let me tell you, Michael, that first of all, Mexico is not a failed state.
It's a failure of law enforcement, not of the state.
That's right. It's a state of failed law. In fact, it's a very successful state as a puppet of U.S. imperialist goals. It's a rather two-faced charge coming out of Washington to justify the militarization of Mexico, more U.S. military aid, more U.S. support for the reactionary forces that have taken over the country, including the Catholic Church, the ultra-right wing, and so on. Now, a lot of those forces had more or less taken over the country earlier under the PRI, but it's become so evident under the PAN that now everyone says the PRI is a shoo-in to win the election of 2012. And this doesn't even take into account the fact that the election of 1988 and subsequently 2006 were completely illegitimate elections where the true winner, a candidate of the center-left, had his votes taken away from him. So that's why the government, in my opinion today, is an illegitimate government. It's a fraudulent government based on electoral fraud. Its candidate, Lopez, candidate who had the election stolen in 2006, Lopez Obrador, is running for president again, not with a political party at this point, on his own, in 2012, because his political party, the PRD, Party of the Democratic Revolution, has become corrupted like the PAN and the PRI. So you have all these social movements, including the one behind the Zapatistas and the indigenous movements throughout Mexico, including the ones behind López Obrador, all these social movements and labor movements, huge labor movements and student movements going on in Mexico today, outside of the political spectrum in the sense that they don't trust any of the political parties at this point. Therefore, what's going to happen? Sooner or later, there's going to be a social explosion. And meanwhile, this huge repression coming down on the social movements in the name of fighting these narco gangs. The narco gangs, some of them are actually integrated with the Mexican government. In that sense, it's a narco state. So there may be internecine strife among the gangs, but the vast majority of the 34,000 killed, civilians mostly, 34,000 killed in 4 years of this current illegitimate government of Calderon, are social movement activists or innocent civilians. Two terms are now accepted as part of the common lexicon, even in the press of Mexico, the controlled press: feminicidio and juvenicidio, feminicide and youthicide. To be female or young in Mexico is to be criminal. And that's why you have more deaths in Mexico than in all the Iraq War and many other serious situations in the world. By the Iraq War, I meant deaths of Americans in Iraq. Obviously, there's a million or more deaths in Iraq.
Jim Cockcroft, you write in Mexico's Revolution Then and Now about the narcotics trafficking. The two opposing gangs, one of which you make the point is sort of integrated in the current government. And I wanted to ask you about that and ask you about the relationship that the United States has with these gangs and the sincerity of the proclaimed war on drugs.
Well, first of all, there are many gangs. I just happened to mention the two fighting it out on the turf of Ciudad Juarez and Tamaulipas in northern Mexico. There's a third one called the Zetas, which are former Mexican soldiers trained by the United States military. And the Zetas are the most bloodthirsty gang, and they operate throughout Mexico. And there are several other gangs. However, to answer your question, it's a fake war. It always has been, by the way, for over 30 or 40 years now. When they gave up the shibboleth about communism after the collapse of the Soviet Union, they heightened the shibboleth against narco-trafficking. But the reason the war is a false war and is allowed to go on and, in fact, grow in terms of the production of liquid cash, it's the second or third largest producer of liquid cash in the world economy today after arms trade and some would say after sex trafficking. But follow the dollar. Where do the dollars end up? They get laundered, and 80% of those dollars, according to most estimates, end up in the hands of the bankers of the six largest banks in the United States of America. The bailout of the U.S. banks by the Obama administration is chicken feed compared to what's really saving the banks, which is the drug money. That's what's been saving the banks this last 3 years. So if you follow the dollar and you understand, as Obama insisted in his State of the Union message, that we have to support big business and this is a government that doesn't want to leave out the downtrodden but nonetheless has to, you know, support the banking community and big corporations and so on, then you realize that the foreign policy is going to reflect that. So that's what the foreign policy has been in the Middle East all along. That's what it's been in Latin America all along. And, of course, because the economy is in recession and because U.S. imperialism has earned so many black eyes by now in world public opinion and is being outcompeted by the euro vis-a-vis the dollar and the yen and now the Chinese currency as well, you have economic empire in decline. So its only strength, where it's number one, actually is not the economy. That's not true. Obama was wrong when he said that in his speech. The United States is number one only militarily now. And that's why you have a return to dirty wars, militarization, military coups, as in Honduras, in Latin America, and all these wars. And troops, U.S. troops and military bases, according to the football announcements, when you watch the football Sunday afternoon on television, 175 countries with U.S. troops and six new military bases in Colombia, four in Panama, two in Honduras, and I predict soon there'll be one in Mexico.
Jim, in addition to following the dollar, let's follow the oil. You write in your book that Mexico and four other countries in Latin America provide 50% of the oil to the United States.
That's true. And, of course, Mexico and Venezuela are the big ones. And that's why U.S. policy is so geared around Venezuela and Mexico, but not just inside Venezuela and Mexico, in the neighboring countries, as in the case of Colombia, which is where all this narco war strategy was first implemented in Latin America on a massive scale. Colombia, as you know, became a military dictatorship behind a civilian facade, completely integrated with many of the major drug traffickers of that country. In the case of Mexico, only less than 1% of the largest cartel, the Sinaloa cartel, has suffered any kind of police or military persecution, that is, detention of people, and they've been released soon after. So all the killings by the military of any narco traffickers are outside of the Sinaloa cartel. The Sinaloa cartel is integrated with the PAN government and has been for 10 years now. The oil is just part of the story. Gradually, the neoliberal governments of Mexico have been privatizing oil, which is by the Constitution of 1917, and here's where the Mexican Revolution of 101 years ago comes into play. It established the 1917 Constitution that says oil and other natural resources belong to the nation, not to private corporations, in other words. Now, they haven't succeeded in completely privatizing oil yet, but that's the struggle that's going on today, and the U.S. wants the oil.
Let's continue on that thought with respect to the revolution of 1910. In your book, you talk a lot about the Magonistas, the two brothers, and what they stood for and what they tried to accomplish. And that's pretty much a hidden history here in the United States, but it's a marvelous history. And I wanted to ask you about them.
Well, what's interesting is that it's a very alive history in Mexico today. The Zapatistas, when they declared their rebellion in 1994, actually used phrases, word for word, that were used by the Magonistas 110 years earlier when they started in the early 1900s. And they continue to do that. The newspaper of López Obrador, the winning candidate of 2006, has the same name as the newspaper as of the Magonistas, Regeneración. There are towns throughout the country named Ricardo Flores Magón, the more famous of the two brothers who died in a federal penitentiary of the United States, Fort Leavenworth, in 1921. The figure of Ricardo Flores Magón is important, Michael, because he's predecessor. He's, in a sense, he knew Lenin's theory of imperialism before Lenin articulated it. He formulated the theory of imperialism. He formulated Trotsky's sense of internationalism before Leon Trotsky formulated it. He's a precursor of the great Marxist revolutionaries in history. He implemented the demands of the Communist Manifesto and the Paris Commune. In his praxis, he and his followers organized what was called the Commune of Baja California in 1911, where they took over the means of production, the workers and the peasants did, and operated them for themselves and distributed all the products to the population according to need. According to the need of the people. The influence of the Magonistas was so strong in the Mexican Revolution of 1910 that the very slogan of the Zapata movement of Emiliano Zapata in southern Mexico was land and liberty, which was the slogan of the Magonistas, and was delivered to Emiliano Zapata personally by an emissary of the Magonista movement. The Magonista movement existed before the 1910 revolution. It led several dozens of armed rebellions and many more strikes throughout the country in the face of total 100% repression in 1906-7-8, right on up to the explosion of 1910. Then they were crushed, but they influenced the Zapatistas enough so that a whole book was written about the Zapata movement called The Commune of Morelos, because they too, the Zapatistas, took over the means of production. And the rest of the world should know this, because this is what we have to do today, frankly. We have to take the banks out of the hands of the bankers and take the factories out of the hands of the industrialists and let the people run them. The Zapatistas did it successfully. The Magonistas did it successfully until they were repressed. And in the case of the Zapatistas, it was the biggest sugar mills in the world, next to Hawaii at the time. So now, all this Magonista ideology that I've just described to you, in effect, with factual history, is very much in the air in Mexico and is being adopted by more and more people, especially in the youth movement.
We're speaking with Dr. James D. Cockcroft, who has written Mexico's Revolution, Then and Now, a book just published by Monthly Review Press. Jim, talk to us about the difficulties in store for the movement in Mexico.
The Mexico state is a fascist state in the broad sense of the word. There are these big social movements, so the state and the oligarchy and big business responds with militarization, repression, and shooting people. Now, this is similar to what Pinochet did after the coup in Chile and what the Honduran coup government's trying to do in Honduras today. There are no more human rights in Mexico. Journalists are killed frequently. Youth, women, and so on. Labor leaders. The whole labor movement's being crushed today. That's the other thing fascism does. The first thing it does is crush labor, and that's what's going on. But labor is resisting, and that's what's so dynamic about Mexico today. There's a huge rank-and-file movement, including leadership of independent unions that have always been strong, who have their roots in the Mexican Revolution of 1910 and the Magonistas.
Well, like the copper mine in northern Mexico.
The copper miners and the electrical workers union.
Yeah.
So, I mean, these are big unions, okay? That answers your question about, you know, what kind of a state, what's the situation, what's happening to the movement. The movement's alive, but it's being repressed. The movement is growing, but it's being savagely attacked. And without international unity, the movement already would have been crushed. But fortunately, the United Steelworkers, one of whose representatives was just arrested in Sonora, Mexico, okay, right, has united and is thinking now of, is planning a merger with the copper workers of Cananea and what's called the Miners Union in Mexico. That's all miners, not just copper. Okay? Mining. So if you get international mergers of big unions, and if you get international solidarity from human rights, labor, student, and other groups in North America, which we have built over the last 10 years in Canada and United States, then these movements can stay alive and even grow. And that's what's been happening. I'm a member now of two civil society international tribunals, one on trade union freedom and the other on the conscience of the movements of people. And that's the migratory flow question and the rights of immigrants, more human rights being violated, immigrants being massacred, tortured in the United States, not just in Mexico.
Jim, you've been a scholar and an activist since the 50s. You've written some 45 books, and you've just given us Mexico's Revolution Then and Now. What was it that brought you to write this particular book?
Well, of course, I've had Mexico in my heart for a long time, and I actually started my international activism in the 50s working with the peasantry in Baja California against the contamination of the irrigation water from dirty water coming from Goldwater's Ranch in Arizona and the Rio Colorado water across the border. And I've been in the thick of defending the political prisoners and social struggles of Mexico ever since. This particular book I felt needed to be writing because I see an explosion coming and people don't understand what's happening in Mexico. They need to understand it right away. And the book is short and hard-hitting, and it's documented, so it's 165 pages. You can get it from monthlyreview.org. That's monthlyreview.org, and you'll follow the printed word there on how to get the book, probably at a discount. Then if you need me for a guest lecture anywhere, you can call Monthly Review at 212-691-2555. I'm on Eastern lecture tour now. I go out west in the spring. I take up the reins of Rocinante again and ride my horse onto the university campuses next fall because this book, I think, really does deserve a hearing. And I think Mexico is the key to the future of Latin America, but I don't have time to explain why. But it's certainly the key to the future of the United States, which is absolutely gasping for its energy resources, not just oil, water.
Well, Jim Cockcroft, you and I and our listeners are not just tilting at windmills with Don Quixote. There's some actual progress that could be made here, all the more so because of your very fine book, Mexico's Revolution Then and Now. Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. We go now to hear excerpts from a reading and a discussion from acclaimed Israeli historian Ilan Pape. This was at New York's Alwan for the Arts this past December. Mr. Pape will discuss Israel's Operation Cast Lead, which was described by a UN fact-finding mission as, quote, a deliberately disproportionate attack designed to punish, humiliate, and terrorize a civilian population. Ilan Pape is professor of history at the University of Exeter in the UK, where he is also co-director of the Exeter Center for Ethno-Political Studies and director of the Palestine Studies Center. He is author of the best-selling The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, A History of Modern Palestine, and, along with Noam Chomsky, Gaza in Crisis. Let's take a listen.
What I would like to do in the 45 minutes is to, first of all, give a very short background for the book, which is the main cause for this event, Gaza in Crisis, that I co-authored with Noam Chomsky, and then use some of the main chapters in this book to make a larger point about the kind of discussion which I think is not only taking place between Noam Chomsky and myself, but which is taking place between various components of the solidarity movement with the Palestinian people, including within the Palestinian politics, or polity, so to speak. And these are very crucial issues, I think. One of the reasons we decided to write a book about an internal debate between two people who, for a very long time, support the Palestine issue, was to have a friendly debate between two people who disagree about almost everything that has to do today with the grand picture, which is called the Palestine issue, and yet have a lot of common ground. And I think that's a typical situation. We are all in it. And I'm not sure, as I'm less aware about the scene in the United States, so I don't know how much it is relevant to what goes on here. But definitely coming from Europe, I'm very much aware that there is an internal debate about these issues. And again, the debate reflects a larger problem of fragmentation, disunity, and sometimes loss of orientation within the Palestinian national movement in general. And that happens often, by the way, that the solidarity movement echoes problems within the movement it wants to support. I think we wanted to push forward a dialogue, at least in the solidarity movement, because the agency is for the Palestinians themselves, of course, to solve the problem of disunity and fragmentation. Nobody can do it for themselves, but we hope to have a more positive impact on that kind of a debate. And that was the background for the book, because we felt we represented more than ourselves. And if it was just the two of us, I don't think it would have been important enough. But we felt that three or four issues that we decided to discuss jointly are three or four issues which concern the solidarity movement with the Palestinians in general. So let me just do the following. Talk about these three and four issues. I'm not going to move from one side of the table to the other and say, now I'm Noam and then I'm Ilan. You'll have to read Noam's position in the book. I mean, that's what I promised the publishers anyway, that I will try and help and sell the book. So I'm giving you only half of the book. If you don't buy it, you are going to be a bit frustrated because you're going to see half of the film, and that's not good enough. The first issue that we, and that really was an old debate between us that also opens the book, is an attempt to understand what lies behind the American support for Israel. It's not that many of us do not know the answer to this question. I'm sure many of you in this room, especially here in New York, if I ask you to come to a class of mine in the university and tell the students, why do you think the United States supports Israel, or why is it important to understand why the United States support Israel, I don't think you'll have a problem of doing that. So there isn't any, despite of WikiLeaks, there isn't any new material that we didn't know before. I mean, it's not like a kind of a difficult code that you have to decipher. I think it's quite easy. However, it's interesting that since the publication of John Mirschmeyer and Stephen Wold's book about AIPAC, we are debating, and it's good that we are debating, the questions of the innuendos on the focuses of American policy rather than the big picture. I mean, the big picture, in a way, I think is clear. And I think for activists, less than for academics, for activists to understand which constitutive element in American policy is more important than the other is crucial. It's crucial. You can either be very defeatist and say the crucial elements are so powerful that if we are just ordinary citizens, we'll have to take it for granted that this kind of policy would continue and there's very little we can do, either as citizens or as members of the civil society. However, if you think that there are different constitutive elements and mainly some that could be challenged from bottom up or by people who do not necessarily belong to the political elite, that makes a change for the kind of agenda that you develop, especially among the Arab American community, the Palestinian American community, and the progressive circles in this country who are committed and interested in the Palestine question. My own take in this book is that as a historian, I think the American support for Palestine and the American support for Israel have fluctuated throughout the years in a way that actually shows that it would be very wrong to adopt a determinist approach for the future. So what I try to do, very different from what Noam does in the book, I try to highlight the chapters and the junctures in history where actually the American impulse as an establishment, as a regime, was to support the Palestine issue rather than to negate it. And I believe that highlighting these chapters in history are important for anyone who takes a bit of a simplistic and reductionist view of American policy towards Israel today. And I will just mention briefly two of many points or historical junctures that I mentioned there. One juncture is the American support, the basic American impulse or positive impulse on the Palestine issue in the 1950s, the early 1950s, during the days of the Dwight Eisenhower administration. Eisenhower's administration in the collective Arab memory is plays a very negative role. After all, this is the administration that put forward a containment strategy and struggled very harshly and very ruthlessly against progressive Arab leaders and regimes. And the feeling was that actually they sort of imported into the Middle East the Cold War in the times of Eisenhower. But he was very different on Palestine for some bizarre reason. It's very interesting. He and his Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, were not convinced that, A, there was a justification for a Jewish state. They thought that Arabs and Jews could share the land. Nor were they convinced by the Israeli arguments against the right of the refugees to return. Now, you have to remember, 1952 and 1953, the idea that the refugees can return seem quite plausible because their houses in some cases were still there, the villages were still there, the refugees themselves were living in very temporary conditions, so that this did not seem strange unless you were totally convinced by the Zionist ideology that the return undermines the Jewish demographic majority in the state. And neither Dulles nor Eisenhower were convinced that this was the case. And this is the background for the foundation of AIPAC, which was the brainchild of the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations in the 1950s, Abba Ibn, who was very worried about this shift in American position. And together with some people who worked in the United Nations press office, who were supporters of Zionism, they created the first nucleus and sort of cohort of people that eventually brought to the world the pro-Israeli lobby. So the pro-Israeli lobby actually was needed because apparently, even as high up as the White House, sometimes there are people with an impulse to support the Palestinians rather than the Israelis. And that was something that Abba Ibn was very worried about. He thought if the president can speak about refugees and Palestinian, who knows who else could join him. And I think that's an important lesson to learn. And I think rather than focusing on the debate that Chomsky had with, for instance, with Mearsheimer and Walt, whether AIPAC is or is not very important, it's far more important to my mind to study why AIPAC came into being, and not in a simplistic way, to understand exactly why Israel was doing that. Another chapter which is quite interesting deals less with the administration, but with a very complex relationship between Christian Zionism and the State of Israel. And I thought it was important also to highlight that chapter, because as probably many of you know, Christian Zionism was not a very pro-Zionist movement to begin with. And that's definitely not a pro-Israeli movement. And they were not allowed to have annual conferences in Israel until another Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, Benjamin Netanyahu, said, why not? Let's invite them to have annual conferences in Jerusalem. Let's have an unholy alliance with these people. Because, of course, the divine scheme that they believe in, as you know, is partly Zionist and partly is very anti-Semitic. The Zionist part is that the return of the Jews to the Holy Land precipitates the second coming of the Messiah. The second part is that in that case the Jews would have to convert to Christianity or be shish kebabbed in hell. And the barbecue in hell somehow was forgotten in the 1990s. And these people with these little scenarios of Jews on a barbecue doesn't bother anyone because of their political power and impact in the United States. So the difference, I think, in the stresses between us is that I do think that it's time to divorce the Palestine issue from the general picture of American imperialism or the fight against American imperialism or that the Palestinians should wait for the big international socialist revolution. I think we should focus, for the sake of the urgency of saving the Palestinians, on something more confined. It's not very revolutionary, it's not very ethical maybe, but it's the only thing that would save the Palestinians. I remember the days in London where the only people who were admitted to a solidarity meeting with the Palestinians had to look so radical that I think even Che Guevara would have been considered a lawyer for Wall Street and would not have been admitted. So I think there's time to focus on this. The second issue is no less important, and I think this has to do with how do you view the essence of the conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And it has to do with the paradigm of peace, so to speak. Many of us were convinced that, for many years, that the idea of partition as a principle is a good idea. The two-state solution is the mantra that eventually would produce a feasible peace on the ground. For that matter, accepted that in order to push forward an effective peace process, you have to focus on the fate of the territories that Israel had occupied in June 1967. And then, of course, you define yourself as being pro-peace or against peace according to how far are you willing to go with creating a situation in which Israel fully withdraws from the areas it had occupied in the June 67 war, and how independent and how sovereign would be the Palestinian polity that or political outfit that would emerge instead of the Israeli rule. I try to argue in the book that this was always a wrong approach, and definitely today it's the wrong approach. And I'm trying to ask, actually, to get away from the tendency in the peace process industry on the one hand, but also among peace activists on the other, from the attempt to shrink the issue of Palestine geographically and demographically, namely to focus on the fate of the people who live under occupation for the last 42 years, and to say this is Palestine and this is the issue of Palestine. It's not surprising, by the way, that the Palestinians who live under occupation were the main pushers and main motivating force for us to focus on the fate of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip as the fate of Palestine or as the issue of the conflict. But I think it is wrong. And the way I try to tackle this is claiming that a very important part in reducing the issue of Palestine geographically to the mere 20% of the land and to a very small number of Palestinians, excluding the Palestinians in Israel, excluding the Palestinians in the refugee camps, in the exilic communities, I think that one of the main reasons is a very successful Israeli campaign for denying the Nakba, for denying what happened in 1948. And I try to show in the book the history of denial in Israel of the events of 1948. And I try also to show the shift in my own understanding of that denial. When I wrote first about this denial, I thought that the Israeli inclination and reluctance to open this Pandora box and admit the kind of criminal policies that they have pursued in 1948, which I call in my book the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. I thought that the main reason for this Israeli reluctance was, and I was hopeful in those days, was that they felt bad about what they had done in 1948. I think I was wrong. I don't think that was the problem, but I really believed it was a problem. I was influenced by my own family and by people I knew who were part in 48, and I thought what I sensed there is a shame, definitely they know what they had done. More or less Jewish soldiers 3 years after the Holocaust behaved in a way which was not that different from the way that the Nazis behaved. And that was something that I said to myself, of course, how can they sort of put it forward and discuss it openly and freely? That doesn't, psychologically doesn't make any sense. But I think that is not the reason. I think the reason is that 1948 was the ultimate Zionist solution for the most basic mismatch that the Zionist movement represents. The mismatch between a genuine wish to create a democratic or a liberal democratic or socialist democratic, it doesn't matter, but democratic, the stress is on a democratic state, namely one which is ruled by and governed by the rule of the majority and represents any developments in liberal democracy, liberal democratic regimes in the West, on the one hand, and the fact that this has to be always and forever a Jewish majority. The books on democracy that they have written has this bizarre idea that democratic majority is valid only if it is ethnically valid as well, or religiously valid as well. Namely, only a majority of Jews constitute a democratic majority. And it takes time for Israelis who are born into the system to understand this fallacy and this very bizarre way of explaining democratic values. And I don't think the political science department in Israel are doing a very good job in explaining that, because they have this general introductions about what democracy is, and then they teach about the Israeli democracy, and I think the two have nothing in common in this respect. But nonetheless, I think 1948 was the mismatch, was the solution for the mismatch. Namely, if you have a real problem with numbers, and they had a real problems in numbers, either under the map that Israel was given in the partition resolution in November 47, or according to their own map in March 1948, when they decided that apart from what today is the West Bank and the Gaza Strip would be the future state. In both these geographical spaces, the Jews were a minority. And they had to decide, how do you create a Jewish majority when the Jews are a minority? And the very clear answer they gave was to kick out the Palestinians. And in the process, to destroy half of Palestine's villages, half of Palestine's towns, massacre thousands of Palestinians in order to make the point. But that was the motive. And I think that the denial of that is not shame, is not a reluctance to face your unpleasant chapters. And it happens in national history where you rather go for the gratifying chapters in your history and you sort of put aside the more unpleasant ones. No, I think that was the idea that the way you solve this mismatch should not be discussed. This is classical labor Zionism. You don't discuss these things, you do them. They were always annoyed by the revisionist movement in Israel because they have a tendency to explain what they're doing and discuss it. And the labor movement does not believe in it. It believes in doing it. It's better to colonize the West Bank than to talk about greater Eretz Israel ideology. It works better. And it's not surprising that the present Israeli government is the best ambassadors for the Palestine cause, because they talk openly about what anyway Israeli governments were doing before, and they want even to legislate de facto practices against Palestinians in Israel, because they need to explain, they need to show that this is legitimate and so on. And this was never, I think, the modus operandi of the Zionist movement. So the idea of not dealing with 1948 has to do with not opening up the basic immoral foundation of the Jewish state. And I think that the Jewish state is based on an immoral foundation. And we have a problem with that. Now, therefore, I argue in the book, and I don't think Noam totally agrees with it, but that doesn't matter. I argue that we have to open up the question of the ideology of the Jewish state and highlight it as the main obstacle for peace. Not the Israeli policies, not the Israeli strategies, but the Israeli ideology. Very much like apartheid as an ideology was the barrier for reconciliation in South Africa. I really believe that this requires all kinds of changes in the dictionary that we use. I think we should re-enter into the dictionary the words colonialism, and we should get used to the idea that if even Muslims, even some radical Muslims, can be anti-colonialists. I know it's difficult, but even women with hijab and men with beards, even Che Guevara had a beard, can be anti-colonialist. And I think that we have to go back to colonialism and anti-colonialism in order to have the analysis, but also the prognosis for the Palestine issue. Another point of discussion is about the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement, the BDS. I think we have a very open, and I'm happy we have an open discussion, because as you know, this discussion has eroded somewhat the unity of the solidarity movement, the idea of the boycott, especially the cultural boycott, and in particular, the academic boycott of Israel. And again, I'm speaking from the viewpoint of Europe, so I'm not sure how much I reflect similar problems in the United States. But definitely in Europe, this is an issue that can divide people, despite the fact that everybody wants to be in the same solidarity movement. I put a case there, I hope strong enough, with a very little reservation about my total support for this idea that Israel should be made into a pariah state. I think it's a rogue state, and rogue states should be made into pariah states. And I think you don't have to invent the wheel. I think that...
If you're just joining us, we're listening to an excerpt from Gaza in Crisis, Reflections on Israel's War Against the Palestinians, by Ilan Pape, acclaimed Israeli historian.
Yeah, I'll take it briefly, very, very briefly. Well, we definitely differ, which is good. I think that when the Israelis are the only ministerial committee the Israelis have established against developments in the outside world that refer to Israel's image, the only ministerial committee the Israelis have ever established was in reaction to the boycott, even before the boycott started. I've never seen a non-event such as the boycott created so much fear and hysteria in Israel. So we have a different, probably, measure of judgment. I judge things according, but that's my limited Israeli background. I judge things according to the Israeli hysteria, barometer of hysteria, to judge whether we are effective or not. And I don't know what your master plan is, but I haven't heard the Israelis being worried about your idea to bring down America. But I do know that the Israelis are a bit worried about what happens to Israeli academic institutes and culture. So until I would be I will see proof that this is not creating fears in Israel and it is not triggering a debate in Israel, which it does, I would continue to support it. So we differ here. I said it before about boycott. These are issues where we should continue to talk about, but we need a bottom line. And secondly, I think you are underestimating the power of galvanization and power of an empowerment that the boycott issue has contributed to the Palestinian society on the ground. This was the only alternative people found for suicide bombing, as in order to try and show resentment to the Israelis. So I think it has a non-violent element to it, which I haven't mentioned, which I think has to be accounted. And not everything in this world can be judged by an assured result, because our lifespan is such that in the case of Israel and Palestine, most of these things would be witnessed, hopefully, by our grand-grandchildren. So we have to be modest about that. The worker state and so on, I come back to the issue. I fully support this agenda and so on, but I really think that we have to be more savvy strategically on the Palestine issue. And if it would be only a socialist agenda, we tried that before, it doesn't work. And I'm saying this, I want to stress again why I'm saying this. I'm saying this because I think you may underestimate what the Israelis are planning in the next stages. And that's why you need a far more pragmatic kind of alliance of people and forces and even ideologies in order to stop the Israelis, even if it offends your more universal visions of a better world.
Okay, right here in the red.
Repeat it anyway.
Where do the struggle against the military occupation on the ground and the flotilla movement, so to speak, fit into this general strategy? I limited my analysis to things that we discuss in the book. On the flotilla, I start with the flotilla, it's easier. I come now from a conference in Stuttgart, in Germany, with among the participants was Haidar Eid from Gaza, who was a strong believer in secular democratic state, a very brave man that only now, after 5 years, succeeded in getting out of Gaza. And I think that if he says, and that's what he said, that we in Gaza want a tsunami of flotilla, who am I to say anything else about that? That's about that. And probably, if I think he represents something that the people of Gaza feel, and definitely. I think similar, who can be against the popular committees and their very brave struggle against the construction of the wall, against the demolition of houses in Sidwan and Abu Dis and so on. I'm trying, I think, to have sort of a larger picture. I think one of the main problems, and I realize it, that because the Zionist movement, later Israel, fragmented the Palestinians in such a way, at every given moment in history, there's more than one Palestinian group that deserves our attention, that is suffering from a direct Israeli abuse. We should be very careful not to do in hierarchy of saying this group in Gaza is more important than the Palestinians in the Nakab who are suffering now from an Israeli oppressive policy, or from the people in Silwan that are being chucked out of their village. The thing that we can do is to have a more coherent strategy rather than support that or other particular action on the ground. And I feel that there is a division of labor here. And I don't know, I'm still not convinced that there's anything else that people here in New York can do apart from making Israelis uncomfortable here. And I think that's very good if you can do this. And I don't think you can participate in the dialogue on the ground for a different kind of reality between Israelis and Palestinians. They would have to do it, although I know that some Jews in New York feel that they are part of that reality as well. I'm here to tell them that I exclude them from that community. I don't want any one of them to share with me the land of Israel. And I want every one of my Palestinian friends in Nazareth to share with me the land of Israel. So they are not welcome. But they are welcome to help me to build this joint future together. And I think that's what I mean by that.
Gaza in Crisis, Reflections on Israel's War Against the Palestinians, by Ilan Pape, acclaimed Israeli historian.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, or hear a segment you've missed, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. Now, you should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Become a friend and send Law and Disorder to your friends through Facebook.
If you like this kind of old folk music, check out Down Home Radio at downhomeradioshow.com.